Welcome back to the Neural Network, the podcast where we explore the amazing ways that your brain and your body work together. In this case, today, we're going to talk about how they work together to keep you moving, thinking, and feeling your best. I'm Nick, and today we're diving into a fascinating question. Why do some people choose exercise over the couch, even when there's a plate of cookies sitting right in front of them? How does your brain process the ability to make a decision to choose whether or not to exercise or to lay on the couch and eat some cookies or pizza or chips, you name it? That's what we're diving into. All right, we are back after the long-awaited break. There was a bit of an interim, so now we are on season two. Let's just say that we're starting season two. Why not? Okay. Yeah, so we took a little bit of a break from the podcast. There was a lot of things going on since we were moving from, of course, from Seattle to Wisconsin. So now we are up and running in Wisconsin at the university. And so, as always, any of the views in this show represent the views of myself and myself only and do not represent those of any professional organizations affiliated. But yes, so we were changing lab space, going from Seattle to Wisconsin. And as a result, that apparently takes a lot more work than we originally thought. And so podcast had to take a little bit of a backseat there for a little bit until we kind of sort of got things settled. But hey, exciting. Here we are. So back to doing some podcasts. And so today we're going to talk about a paper that I was reading. I thought the paper was actually a fantastic paper. It was one of those papers that you go through and you read it. It's very easy to read. And I found myself just from the text alone, knew what was going on. Didn't even have to go through the figures initially. And so then, you know, that I always like when you're reading through the paper and you find yourself not having to always go back and forth between the text and the figures, because that can sometimes get a little bit confusing, and it sort of makes the whole experience of reading a paper kind of choppy as we're sort of going through the paper. Anyways, so this paper was in Nature Neuroscience, and it was talking about orexin neurons in the brain. So orexin neurons are in this case, we're talking about the orexin neurons in the hypothalamus. And the title of the paper was Orexin Neurons Mediate Temptation-Resistant Voluntary Exercise. And it was by a Swiss group led by, let's see, first author Alexander Tesmer and the senior authors Peleg Reibstein and Dennis Bertikoff. I probably butchered those. I apologize in advance. But regardless, what is the sort of basis of this paper? This paper was talking about voluntary exercise, or essentially a decision-making process between exercising and choosing highly palatable food. And so whenever we're struck with the ability to decide between whether or not we want to exercise or to choose the lazier option of indulging ourselves in a gluttonous fashion by ingesting highly palatable food, the brain is struck with a critical decision that has to be made. And it goes further than just, do I want to eat this and do I want to exercise? But it goes much deeper into that. Do I want to indulge myself into a behavior that allows me to intake highly palatable food, which of course comes with that a large amount of energy, which from a survival mechanism is very good, right? We tend to think that the brain is going to favor things that are energy storage promoting, or at least energy consuming promoting, versus that of energy expending when we just go back to sort of a primitive state. But at the same time, exercise itself does have very beneficial effects, not only for cognitive function, but for overall body function. And when we dive, you know, even a little bit deeper into that, we have to weigh in the fact that exercise in and of itself, when we put the work in initially, makes the body into a state, or trains the body into a state, where it's able to better deal with the physical demands that may be necessary, at least primitively, in order to hunt down, track food, in order to move around, to gather different foraging items. You know, if we're going back to sort of that primitive state where a lot of the brain structures have arisen from. And so the brain is struck with sort of a very difficult decision. Do I take the easy way and just take the food and sit there, knowing that in the long run, this may be a deleterious activity because it limits my ability to then further grab energy? But at the same time, do I choose exercise, which in the short term is going to be energy burning, not energy saving? And so by that token, you know, most things tend to conserve energy physiologically. And so it's not going to want to do that. But the benefits of it are to increase the ability to then gain energy producing or energy filled fuel later, right? And so there's a lot that goes into it. And the reason that I liked this paper, not only because of the fact that it was a very easy read, and so it went through and you could just read it from top to bottom. There wasn't too many places where you got stuck, had to go look up things, all that kind of stuff, was because it really sort of got at the crux of the intersection intersection between behavior and neurophysiology, or how the brain is actually working. And what I mean by that is that oftentimes in neuroscience in general, I think it's safe to say that there's a bit of a split between how neuroscience is attacked as far as being studied. And one of the ways is the behavioral side of neuroscience. And this is one of the things that draws a lot of students and a lot of people into neuroscience, is that whole behavioral aspect of it, which sort of teeters that line between psychological research and, you know, basic neuroscience research. And that is, you know, how do we study the interaction of different animals, the behaviors of these animals? How do these behaviors actually correlate with common behavioral patterns? And so can we look at the behavior of an animal, and can we predict reproducible patterns that arise with that to understand how our brains sort of dictate whether or not we want to engage in behavior X or behavior Y, and why do we want to choose between one versus the other? And a lot of that is sort of understanding the patterns of common patterns of behavior that arise. The other end of the spectrum is neurophysiology. And of course, neurophysiology is where I spend the majority of my research, and my research career has been rooted. And that's understanding the actual physiological function of the nervous system, right? And so the brain itself is a physiological organ. When we look about all the organ systems, when we talk about physiology, physiology is the study of the organs, the digestive system, the respiratory system, the renal system, the circulatory system, the endocrine system. And then you have your central nervous system. It's a system within the body. And so it's one of those that we study physiologically. And when we study it physiologically, what do we look at? We look at how neurons generate the signals that are being produced within the brain in order to allow different brain regions to talk to each other, right? How do we move ions in and out of cells in order to generate the signals that are necessary for those neurons to talk to each other? How do the glial cells create these transient calcium waves that modulate the activity of those neurons? And how do the changes in receptor composition on those neurons actually change the ability of those cells downstream to hear the signal from that previous neuron? And a lot of that has to do with the neurophysiology. And sometimes when you study that, you have to take brains out, and it makes it very hard then to correlate the activity with the actual behavior itself. And so, with the emerging techniques that are coming out now within neuroscience, of course, like I've always said, any of the findings that we find in neuroscience are always limited to the quiver of tools that we have available to us, right? We can only measure the things that we have access to measure, and we can only make statements about things that we're able to actually measure. And so, you know, put it all together, the only things that we can learn at the moment are based upon the tools that we have to allow us to make those measurements, of which we draw our conclusions from the results, right? But thankfully, you know, with the emergence of many modern techniques and genetic manipulations, we're starting to get a better grasp at how the actual physiology of the neurons creates the behavior or has a causal effect on the behavior of an animal. And it's fascinating because now we can actually dive into the mechanistic insights in the brain that allow us to explain the behaviors that we're actually looking at. And the paper that we're talking about here today did a very nice job, at least in my opinion, of doing that, diving into how does actually changing the activity, or how does the intrinsic activity along with the ability to change it affect a behavioral outcome. And in this case, they were looking at the choice that an animal has between eating highly palatable food. So this is food that we very much enjoy, that we view as something that is very nice to have, and exercise. And so how, when you're given those choices, do you pick between one or the other? And is there a system in the brain, or is there a certain structure within the brain whose activity drives us to choose towards exercising or eating? And if we manipulate that area of the brain, can we actually divert an animal to go towards the food or to go towards the exercise? And that is what this paper did. Okay, so what is orexin? Well, orexin is a neurotransmitter, right? And it's produced in a small area of the brain called the hypothalamus. It's a region of the brain that regulates a lot of essential functions like sleep, arousal, appetite, etc. And there's two types of orexins, orexin A and orexin B. And they both bind to two different receptors in the brain, cleverly named OX1 and OX2. I love when they make the naming easy on us, because then you just know, okay, orexin A and orexin B, and the receptors are OX1 and OX2. Easy, okay? Love that. Anyways, orexin plays a critical role in keeping us awake and alert. When you're sleep deprived, your orexin neurons kick into high gear, and they essentially try to keep you from nodding off. It almost acts like the brain's, I don't know, natural coffee, signaling to different areas of the brain that you need to stay awake and you need to be engaged. And it's actually kind of interesting, right? Because dysfunction in the orexin system is linked with a very common sleep disorder. One of the best known examples is narcolepsy. So with people with narcolepsy, there's a deficiency of orexin-producing neurons, which causes them to suddenly fall asleep during the day or experience excessive daytime sleepiness. And I'm not talking about just like, oh, I feel a little bit of sleepy after lunch. No, people with narcolepsy or problems with the orexin system in context of sleep will just suddenly, boom, fall asleep, right? If you've ever seen that movie, it's an older movie. I know, hopefully I'm not dating myself, but that movie called Rat Race a long time ago, I believe. Hopefully I'm right on this, but in Rat Race, there was that person, I forgot who was playing it, but he had narcolepsy. And so essentially, you know, in the Rat Race movie, they're all trying to race towards this thing to get the money, yada, 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 a lot of things unfold. But, you know, every once in a while, this dude would just fall asleep, gone. Dude was out, okay? And that's narcolepsy, okay? And so that arises from a problem with the orexin system. And because of that, some of the treatments for narcolepsy are actually designed to mimic or enhance orexin signaling, but orexin itself doesn't just influence sleep. At the end of the day, it's just a neurotransmitter. And as we found out many times before, neurotransmitters can have many different actions depending on the state of the brain or where they're being released. A lot of neurotransmitters are used in a lot of things, just depending on where they're located, when they're released, how they're released, all of that kind of stuff. And so orexin itself is also involved in regulating appetite and energy balance. At least the literature thus far has suggested that that's where it plays a large role. So when you're hungry, orexin levels are said to rise, which pushes you to seek out food in order to keep your energy levels up. And the system is also tightly regulated to metabolism. Essentially, basically, it ensures your brain knows when your body needs fuel so that you stay awake long enough in order to find and eat the food. And that's sort of the basic framework of how the orexin system in the hypothalamus has been framed to date. And of course, anytime that you have these systems that are involved in motivation or energy levels and things like that, there's also a tie in to reward systems. So orexin is thought to be tied into reward systems in the brain, possibly playing a role in motivation and even addiction. It's kind of like a multitasking molecule. It affects many different critical processes. So anyways, orexin isn't just a sleep regulator. It plays a complex role in feeding behaviors, reward pathways, and overall arousal. And so obviously in the context of the paper in the Nature Neuroscience paper, we're dealing a lot with the role of orexin in energy output and the choice to choose a behavior that allows you to increase your energy levels, being that of eating. All right, so let's actually lay the framework of the paper itself. And so what the experimenters did, and I think this was a clever little thing, is they created an elevated maze. And so whenever you have an elevated maze for a mouse, and essentially you put them, or I don't know if it was elevated or not, but anyways, you put them on this sort of platform, if you will, and the platform has many different arms. Okay, so it almost looks like a star, you know, but each of the arms is a lot more narrow. And so in this case, it had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It had 8 different arms. And so essentially you put the mouse in the middle of this apparatus that has 8 different hallways that it can go down. And at the end of each of those hallways is something that it can do. And so you take the mouse, you put it down. One of the hallways is just empty, right? Just there's nothing there. You have one that is light, one that is dark, right? Because mice tend to prefer darker places than they do out in the open in the light. They're a prey animal. One has a novel object, something that they've never seen before. And so this presents an opportunity to interact. It also presents sort of an unknown. How willing are they to go towards something that they don't really know? You know, that could have a big payout. It also could have them touch something and then get eaten by a hawk. And so, you know, it has to sort of weigh the pros and cons there based upon the other decisions that it has. Another arm has water. Again, water is necessary for survival, so that's always a good thing to give them the choice. Another one had a novel mouse, a friend, or a foe. You never know, right? But it has a another mouse that it can go and interact with. Of course, mice live in colonies, and so the choice to go towards another mouse is always there. And so the mouse may be compelled to go towards that. The other one has standard chow. Now, if you've ever seen standard mouse or rodent chow, they're just basically like pellets. They almost look like, it almost looks like if you were able to take like a mini wheat and you're able to like compact it and really like just squish it. I know they would normally just sort of crush into crumbs, but you know, wet it a little bit and squish it. And that's kind of what the chow looks like. It's essentially just like a little mini brick of food that has all of the nutritional necessities for that of a mouse. And then on the last arm, there was a wheel, a running wheel, right? And so that is sort of your ability to choose to go and exercise. And so the empty one in this case, so it was empty under controlled conditions, and then under other conditions where they're testing, it had highly palatable food for the mouse. Think some sort of treat-like substance, peanut butter, cheese, whatever. I don't know what they actually used for it, but it was a very highly palatable food for the mouse. Okay, actually, let's look up right now just for funsies, just to see what the actual food was. All right, I found it. It is a milkshake. They used strawberry flavored milkshake as the highly palatable food. All right, I guess. And it says it's highly palatable and attractive for both mice and humans. And it has references, many references to that, which is kind of funny. So there you go. That's what the highly palatable food was. All right. So that sort of lays the stage. We have the different choices. We got light, dark, novel object, water, novel mouse, mouse chow, milkshake, and wheel. And so how do you do it? You put the mouse in the middle of the apparatus and you say, go. And then that mouse has to choose. Do I want to play with the water? Do I want to play with the mouse? Do I want to eat the disgusting chow? Do I want to play with the novel object? Do I want to go exercise? Or do I want to eat the milkshake? Or do I want to just hang out in the light or in the dark? And there's a beautiful figure on figure one that just shows like a heat map essentially of the time that was spent in each of the arms. And interestingly enough, in the trial where the mouse did not have the highly palatable food, so this is the control trial. So essentially, you have a control trial and you have a highly palatable food trial. In the control trial, you put the mouse down and it has all the options except in the case of the highly palatable food, that one is just left empty. Okay, and so this just gives an idea of how willing is that mouse to interact with everything else besides the highly palatable food. Okay, and then when you put the highly palatable food there, then you can compare what is the effect of having the highly palatable food, right? Okay, so in the first case, without the highly palatable food, the mouse spend the majority of its time either running on the wheel or with the mouse chow. So it's either eating or it's running on the wheel. Interesting, right? In the case of when you put the highly palatable food down, What's interesting is that the amount of time that was spent running on the wheel didn't change. The only thing that changed is instead of eating the chow, it went to the highly palatable food. So now you have a better tasting food. And so all it did was just switch. It just, instead of doing the wheel running and eating the mouse cereal, it went from eating the milkshake and running on the wheel. So either way, when given all of the choices, the thing that the mouse tends to favor is either food or exercise. Doesn't really care about the rest of the stuff. Didn't really spend any appreciable time in any of the other arms. So that in of itself is pretty interesting, right? So that was fascinating. And then the next thing that they did was that they repeated the exact same test, but in this case, they did it in the presence of something that blocks the orexin receptors. And so you inject the mouse with the drug. The drug was, let me see what the name of the drug was. It was called almorexant. And so it's just, it blocks both the OX1 and the OX2 receptors. And so if you block the receptors, essentially what you do is in the hypothalamus, those neurons, those orexin neurons that are releasing that orexin, it's no longer able to bind to the neurons in the area of the brain where it's going to have its effect. And so for any time that you have neural signaling, you have, let's say, the orexin neurons in the hypothalamus, those neurons are then going to snake their way over to the areas of the brain where they're going to connect to and have their effect. And when they have their effect, they sprinkle their orexin into that other secondary area of the brain. And then the neurons in those secondary areas respond to that orexin, respond to that sprinkling of the neurotransmitter, and then have their effect. And so when you give the antagonist or you give the drug to orexin, essentially those downstream neurons are unable to hear the effects of those hypothalamus neurons. And so even if those hypothalamus orexin neurons are firing it at very large rates, it doesn't matter. The neurons that they talk to can't hear them anymore. So you've essentially made the ability of those neurons to pick up that signal no longer present, okay? And so the question was, what does that effect have on the behavior of the mouse to choose the different arms in that apparatus? And so again, under normal conditions, the mouse spends the majority of its time either at the wheel or at the choice of food, whether it be highly palatable food or the chow, okay? But in this case, they were using the highly palatable food. And so you give the drug, and you give the drug, and it's very interesting. All that happens is that the time spent at the wheel goes down. And the mouse tends to prefer spending the majority of its time at the highly palatable food, drinking the milkshake. It's fascinating, right? And so essentially then you put the mouse down, and now that mouse is no longer able to have its orexin system working in the way that it usually is. And when that's the case, the mouse no longer is really interested in going to exercise anymore. It just wants to go to the milkshake and drink the milkshake. And that's kind of fascinating, right? And so they did a series of controls as well. And so they were looking at, you know, is the actual activity of the mouse just reduced? Does giving the drug just sedate the mouse in a way that it doesn't really want to move much anymore? And so does it just go towards the highly palatable food and then just sit there because it doesn't want to move anymore? So they did some of those controls, and that wasn't the case, right? And so it seemed to be more affecting the decision of going to the highly palatable food versus that of the wheel, right? And so when the food was available to them, the highly palatable food, and the mouse chose to go and exercise, they termed that temptation-resistant voluntary exercise, okay? So this is almost like all exercise that humans do, temptation-resistant voluntary exercise, right? Because for the most part, we have the ability to choose, do we want to eat or do we want to exercise? In this case, of course, with mice and stuff, if you know, in a laboratory setting, if they don't have the food and then they just go and exercise out of boredom, it's not temptation-resistant exercise because they don't have anything else to choose from, right? But in this case, they can choose between the milkshake and the wheel. And so when the choice is there, it's a temptation resistant voluntary exercise. Anyways, okay, so that's just, you know, that's one of the terms that they use. And I thought that was kind of an interesting thing. But yeah, so anyways, when you block the orexin receptor signaling, or you block the ability of those orexin neurons to do their normal function, the mouse doesn't seem to be interested in making the decision of going to exercise anymore. And it just wants to go and drink the milkshake. And so what it suggests is that the orexin neurons of the hypothalamus, one of the jobs that they play when given the decision between a highly palatable food, milkshake, pizza, fries, burger, whatever, and exercise, they actually seem to fire in a fashion that pushes you to go and exercise rather than eating the food. And that's very interesting, right? And it brings up a whole host of questions of, you know, well, how do those orexin neurons then actually fire? And in individuals that are more prone to sedentary activity or inactivity in favor of eating, do those individuals have less firing of those hypothalamic orexin neurons under baseline conditions? Is there a genetic predisposition for the motivation to go and exercise versus not? And is there plasticity in the system? Can we train that system? Anything in the brain is theoretically able to be trained to strengthen and to weaken synapses. And so is there a way to actually train those hypothalamic neurons to be able to fire when you're presented with the choice of going to exercise or not and to go eat food? And so you can obviously see the benefit that this would have on, you know, overall human health, disease. Of course, lack of exercise is associated with every disease basically that there is on the planet. And so how do we actually modulate that system? You know, of course, there's the pharmacological modulation of that system. And yeah, you know, you're seeing some of the things with the different weight loss drugs that are having good and bad effects, whatever. Not getting into that. But whenever we're talking about pharmacological manipulation of a system, it doesn't necessarily address the root behavior that led to it to begin with. And so it's not always an efficacious thing. And so, you know, it's whenever you take the drug, it might be able to, you know, shift you to be able to choose exercise versus not, or motivate you in a way that you want to choose exercise versus not. But I'm more interested in how do the baseline variations in the signaling of this part of the brain correlate with individuals that are more inclined to go exercise versus that of eating highly palatable food, if you know what I mean. And then, of course, is it trained? If you take someone, let's say, that has struggled with obesity for a long time, and you took a look at the firing rate or the activity of those orexin neurons when the individual is presented with the choice of a sedentary eating and going to exercise. Let's say when they're obese, that the firing rate of those neurons is not very high. And so the individual tends to want to be motivated more to go eat than they are to go and exercise. And if you put them on a weight loss regime, and let's say you take them, you know, you sample that years after they've lost weight and kept it off and they enjoy exercising, do the firing rates of those neurons, or does the activity of those hypothalamic orexin neurons change in such a way that now when they're presented with the stimulus of either exercising or highly palatable food, now those neurons are firing to say, hey, you should probably go exercise? I think that would be kind of fascinating. But anyways, so going on with the actual paper, they did some other tests just to dive a bit more into the actual fine details of the phenomenon itself. And so they looked at how long the animal was interacting with the wheel versus that of the strawberry milkshake. So in other words, when the animal went towards the wheel, when it was running on the wheel, depending on whether or not the orexin neurons are able to signal their signal onto the other parts of the brain, does it change the time that that mouse actually spends on the wheel? Are they less motivated to be on the wheel when they are on the wheel? Or, you know, they change the time that they're interacting with the highly palatable food, et cetera. And it doesn't change any of that. And so even when, you know, they give the drug and they are less likely to go to the wheel during the test, the times that they actually still did go to the wheel, the time that was spent at the wheel, of course, it was very much lessened with the drug, but during the times that it was actually there on the wheel, it interacted or ran for the same amount of time that it did before. So it seems that, you know, during each miniature session when it runs on the wheel. So because a mouse, you know, it'll go on the wheel, it'll run for like a 2 seconds, then it'll get off, then it'll go drink a milkshake for a little while, and then it'll come back. And so when you're looking at the time spent at the wheel versus that of the milkshake, you're just looking at the overall time that it wants to spend at each of those. But when you look at the single bouts, and so even though the time that was spent going towards the wheel was less, or the time that was spent in that arm of the maze that contained the wheel was less, whenever it did go over there and it did run on the wheel, it still ran for the same amount of time during its little thing. So 2 seconds, 3 seconds, however long it ran for, was still the same. So it didn't seem to be actually changing the motivation of the mouse once it was running, right? So once it did engage with the exercise, it didn't seem to have an effect. And so what this is saying is that those orexin neurons, once you actually physically engage in exercise, it doesn't seem that they have an effect on your motivation during the exercise itself. What it seems is that these neurons, their main effect is when given a decision to exercise or to not, that is when they play a role. They play a role in the decision-making process to go exercise or to not exercise. Does that make sense? Not actually once they are exercising, okay? So that's a very important distinction, because that's another fascinating system. Once you are exercising, how do you stay motivated when you are exercising, right? Because, you know, in a lot of sports training, things like that, you know, you start to do, let's say, endurance exercise, and that's fun and it works for a long time. And then suddenly the motivation, while you're out there, you start to get bored, you start to feel like not doing it anymore. And you get to a point where you can't ramp up the time, you can always ramp up the intensity, I guess, but you can't ramp up the time anymore. And suddenly your motivation for it starts to go down and down and down. And then maybe your ability to go and exercise or your motivation then goes down. And so there's a whole sort of psychological thing about that that might be useful for people that are, you know, hitting plateaus training wise, things like that, etc. But this is not dealing with that. This is dealing with, or at least this area of the brain seems to only be dealing with, do I go and exercise or do I go through the drive-through? And that is what the system does. And there were some other things that they did. I mean, they really interrogated the heck out of this phenomenon, which is good, right? It's, you know, they really got at the heart of it. And of course, that's why it got into Nature Neuroscience, a very prestigious journal. But one of the other things that they did, they followed it up with a technique called fibrophotometry. And so all that fibrophotometry is essentially you can put a fiber optic cable down into a region of the brain. And once it's there, it allows you to record the activity of the neurons in that area. And you do it through a specific technique or through a specific way. And what you do is essentially that you can genetically or virally make those neurons in that area express a protein that gives off light every time that that neuron is active, right? And so essentially, it's called a GCAMP signal. And basically, any time that that neuron is active, it gives off a little puff of light, essentially. I mean, you have to excite the neurons in order to actually, whatever. There's a process that's involved that you actually have to shine a little bit of light on them to actually get them to do their thing. But regardless of the effect, whenever that neuron is active, you're able to pick up a light signal from them. So essentially, if that neuron is very active, it looks like a strobe light. If it's not very active, it's like you standing there with a flashlight, turning it on and turning it off. And so you put a little fiber rod that goes down into there, that's a fiber optic, and it absorbs the light that comes from those neurons when their activity is either going up or going down, and you can measure the overall activity of the neurons in that area. And it's nice because you can do that in an awake and alert and alive mouse. And so you can do it while they're running around and doing their own thing. And so they did that, and they stuck this fiber down into the hypothalamus in order to listen in to those orexin neurons of the hypothalamus and to see what's actually happens to those neurons when the mouse is given the decision to go and exercise versus go and drink the strawberry milkshake. And as you might expect, when the mouse decides to go and exercise, those neurons light up a lot, right? And they only light up when that mouse is given the choice to go exercise or to go to the milkshake, and it chooses to go to exercise, chooses to go to the running wheel, which is fascinating, right? And so those neurons were sort of, you put the mouse down, it's given the choice. Do I want to go exercise? Do I want to go to the milkshake? The times that it chose to go and exercise, there was an increase in the activity of those neurons in the hypothalamus, those orexin neurons, just prior to that mouse going and choosing to exercise, right? And so what, when we're going back to what I was talking about earlier with trying to disentangle to figure out what are the ways that we could manipulate this system, essentially, you know, what I, you know, interested in, one of the follow-up questions from this paper, and of course, the hallmark of a good study is, you know, it creates more questions than questions that it actually answers. But one of the interesting things from this that I'm curious to know about is what triggers that ramping of those orexin neurons, which then goes down to tell you to go and exercise, right? Where does it come from? What other parts of the brain or what stimuli around you are triggering those neurons to ramp up their activity when, like, right before you make that decision, right? And that's kind of the fascinating thing. And I'm wondering if, let's say, like, smell or something like that is able to change the activity of those neurons right before you make the decision. You know, if you're sitting in your house and there's something that's cooking in the crock pot, for example, and so you have, you're surrounded by the aroma of whatever pot roast or stew that you are cooking in the crock pot, whenever that's present, you know, does the smell of the food stimulate something in the brain that when you're sitting there and you're thinking, do I want to go and exercise or do I just want to sit on the couch and eat? Does the smell prevent the ramping up of those neurons, prevent the ramping up of their activity such that you don't feel compelled to go and exercise when you know that this food, this delicious food is present waiting for you, you know? Or if you have sort of a nauseous type of stimulus, if suddenly you're sitting there and you're at that time of the day when you have to choose, do I want to eat? Do I want to go work out? If suddenly there was a disgusting smell in front of you that, you know, completely put you off to eating. Let's say that you left a Tupperware in your bag, your lunch bag over the weekend, and you had some sort of creamy substance in there or some sort of meat substance in there and it's started to go rancid. You know, we all have encountered that time where you open up that Tupperware and you go, oh, you know, if you were to like take a whiff of that Tupperware when you're struck with the decision to go exercise or to eat something palatable, would that increase the activity of those hypothalamic orexin neurons to then tell you, okay, yeah, I'm going to go exercise because the thought of food right now is absolutely disgusting. Yeah, that's sort of a interesting thing. And it's totally testable, right? Just give a nauseous stimulus when given the assay or the test in order to, you know, decide whether or not you want to go exercise or you want to go to the highly palatable food, right? So kind of an interesting thing. Okay. Anyways, they also did optogenetics in order to actually manipulate the activity of those hypothalamic neurons. And so if fiber photometry is a way that you can measure the activity of those neurons, optogenetics, we have a whole episode on this, is a way that you can actually turn neurons on or off based on specific light sensitive proteins that you put into the neurons themselves. And so essentially you hit them with a laser that opens up an ion channel that allows the neuron to either turn on or to turn off, right? And so essentially what this is saying is that if we increase the activity of those neurons when the mouse is given the decision, if we artificially increase the activity, so now instead of, you know, the random chance that those neurons are going to increase their activity when the mouse has to make a decision to go one way or the other, now we're forcing those neurons to talk, or the authors here, we're forcing those neurons to have an increase in activity when that mouse is giving the decision. Can you force that mouse to then make the decision to go and exercise when given the choice between exercising and the highly palatable food. And so this is, I mean, it's mind control at that point, right? Because you're talking about changing a person, or in this case, changing an animal's decision-making process. And so it is, it's mind control. That's, I mean, I never thought about it that way, but it's kind of weird. So can you put a fiber down in there, stimulate, make them go, and now you're forcing the animal to, you're not forcing the animal to go exercise, you're forcing the animal to choose on its own to go exercise. And that's wild. So that's what they did. And of course, yes, that's what happened. And that's it. That is the study. Fascinating study. It really was. I really did enjoy this study. There's a whole discussion section on that nicely lays out sort of the other complexities of the orexin neurons. Because again, like I said, orexin neurons aren't just involved in this. They're involved in many different things. But it does seem that one of the functions of these neurons is to help you to decide whether or not you want to go and exercise, or do you want to drink a strawberry milkshake. And again, so the name of the paper, one more time for anyone that wants to look it up, although we already went over it: orexin neurons mediate temptation-resistant voluntary exercise. Absolutely fascinating paper. All right, so that's it. So like I said, we're back. We got episodes coming out, episodes being recorded. We got exciting new guests on the way, of course. Apologies for a little bit of interim there, but we're all settled now and ready to go. Okay, so with that, go forth and enjoy your week. All right, bye.